let's go on to this next chapter, which is a chapter about chemistry, and that should make sense. I think I mentioned before that this course is really just as much a chemistry course as it is a biology course because of the scope of 181 versus 182. 181 is all about biology of the cell, and what occurs in a cell is chemistry, and the level is atoms and molecules. So that's where we are for this term. The opening slide in this chapter is a photographic representation. You usually use symbols, but here's a photographic representation of a chemical reaction. A chemical reaction that, you know that it's a chemical reaction because of this arrow. In any given chemical reaction, you start with some number of substances or chemicals known as reactants. In this case, there happen to be two, but it could be one or more than two. And you end up with some number of products. In this case, there's just one product, but it doesn't have to be just one. And that's why the arrow is important. The arrow divides the reactants, however many there are, on one side from the products. And so it's a process. That's what the arrow really indicates. There is a transformation of substance from reactants to products. And therefore, if a reaction occurs, you end up with new stuff that you didn't start with, that is different in at least some ways. It has different properties compared to the reactants. The products do, that is. And this is a pretty profound example of just how different products can be in their properties compared to reactants. Despite the fact that in any given chemical reaction, not just this one, the change that takes place to transform reactants into products happens not because there's anything added or subtracted materially. It's just that there is a rearrangement of particles that these substances are made out of, and that all substances are made out of. All materials in the universe are made out of atoms, which are made of even smaller things that we'll be talking about. And there's just really a rearrangement of those particles that happens in any given chemical reaction. So it's not that it's new stuff in that sense. It's the same particles, just in a different arrangement. But it can be drastically different in properties, as we see in this example. Here we have two reactants, sodium and chlorine, both of which are elements. The elements are substances found on the periodic table of the elements, and I'll talk more about those in a minute. But sodium is a metal, more specifically than saying it's an element. It's a metal, and chlorine is a nonmetal. Sodium is, in addition to just simply being a metal, it is a very highly reactive metal. Dangerous stuff. You would never want to touch it, which is why this person has gloves on. Just the water vapor in your skin will make it violently react if you actually touch it. And so this is stuff that will kill you easily if you're around it haphazardly. Chlorine is a poisonous gas by itself. So it's also stuff that will easily kill you. It's very highly reactive. And that's why it kills the things that are in the pool. You just don't use enough to kill you. All right? So you don't really want to be around either one of these things. But if you get them together and allow the particles that they're both made of to rearrange, then you make a compound, in this case, called sodium chloride, which is just one of many examples of salts. A salt is a specific kind of compound made from a metal and a nonmetal. When we say salt in everyday language, we usually specifically mean sodium chloride. That's table salt. But there's many, many other kinds of salts. Anyway, sodium chloride is not only not going to kill you like the others that make it up do, but it's something that you absolutely can't live without. So that's a pretty fundamental change that has occurred simply by rearranging little particles that these things are made out of without adding anything new or taking away anything. Just a rearrangement. All right, let's go to two. Look at a couple more depictions of chemical reactions. That first one was a photograph. Here on top you see a cartoon version. This one, the cartoons show atoms, and then on the bottom, which is the same reaction, instead of showing photographs or cartoons, it's showing the chemical formulae for these substances, the reactants and the products. So hydrogen gas, oxygen gas, and water as the product. And that's this bottom one is how you usually, after you've learned what chemical reactions are, see chemical reactions depicted using chemical formulae. The formulae just tell you how many atoms of each type there are in the substance. All right, but each of these is a reactant, and I mean each of these is a reaction, and you make new stuff, water, that has properties that the reactants that you started with do not have. Okay. Let's go to three and talk more about elements, which I just briefly mentioned before. An element is a substance. All elements are substances, but not all substances are elements. So what is it that actually defines a substance as an element? What is it that makes something an element? Exactly, yes. An element is a substance made of only one kind of atom. And there is no limit to the number of substances, but there are relatively few elements. You know, kind of goes hand in hand with fundamental versus derived, as I was saying, in lab. The elements, there's only roughly 100 naturally occurring elements. The periodic table grows. There have been some things added to it over time. But these ones at the end are ones that humans have to work hard just to make them happen, and they only last for a tiny fraction of a second, but that's a huge accomplishment within chemistry. So they're not naturally occurring elements. The first roughly 100 are found already formed on Earth and in the rest of the universe. But each of these is an element because each one is, no matter how much of it you have, there's only one kind of atom making it up. Sodium chloride, the example in the first slide, is not an element. It's a compound. A compound is a substance made of at least two or more kinds of atoms. All right, so that's the basic difference between elements and compounds. The table that we see in slide three lists elements that are found in your body. But actually the same would be true for just about any animal. We're just examples of animals. And in fact, it would be true for just about any organism, not just animals. There are several different elements that are necessary for you to live. And most of these are near the top of the periodic table. Now, the periodic table is not a random listing. It's highly ordered. It's a listing in order of size of atoms. And therefore, the ones at the top, the elements at the top, are the smallest elements because they have the smallest atoms that they're made out of. Well, the things that you naturally find in organisms tend to be the ones toward the top. These heavier and heavier elements eventually become dangerous, radioactive, and dangerous for other reasons as well. So those things you really don't want too much in your body. Most of these ones listed here are near the top if you were to look at them at it carefully. But these ones listed with the 3.7% by them, that's how much of your body is made up of these ones. You need every one of these for various reasons, but you don't need all that much. Even fewer are the ones that are trace elements on the bottom. But look at these top four, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. In terms of atoms, if you think of your body as a collection of atoms, then most of those are these four. And that's true for all organisms. Those are the four biggies as far as atoms of organisms are concerned. Now, do you remember me giving you the four categories of macromolecules? And can you name them without looking back at your notes?
Proteins, polysaccharides, lipids, and trans.
Yes, except I said polypeptides instead of proteins, and I'll give you the distinction between those two words later, but yes, thanks, that's good. By the way, if you can't do that, if you have to go back to your notes, then you're falling behind. This is what I meant on the first day when I said you have to learn this stuff a little bit at a time each night listening to these recordings. You cannot cram for it, so keep that in mind. Anyway, good work. All four of those macromolecules contain three of these four. The first three, oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen, are in all four of those. Plus, they're in smaller molecules as well. Nitrogen is, in addition to the three that are in all four categories of macromolecules, nitrogen is in two of them, specifically polypeptides and nucleic acids. So you can't have organisms without these four macromolecules, and you can't have those macromolecules without these four atoms. That's why they're the biggies. And that'll make more sense as we go. Okay, now to four. Now, an atom is an almost unbelievably tiny thing from our viewpoint. For instance, It's actually kind of hard to get a handle on the fact that you have 100 trillion cells, because that is a huge number, right? But just one of your 100 trillion cells has many, many millions of atoms in it. And so you have hundreds of trillions of millions of atoms in your body. Truly tiny things. But as astoundingly tiny as they are, atoms are made of even smaller things. So an atom isn't a solid particle. It is made of smaller and therefore subatomic particles. Subatomic particles simply means it's lower, smaller than the level of the atom. And if this were a physics course rather than a biology course, we could get into the fact that these subatomic particles I'm about to mention are themselves made of even smaller things, but that's beyond biology. In this course, we will just consider these three subatomic particles, the primary subatomic particles that atoms include. And those three categories are electrons, protons, and neutrons. Now, this cartoon version of an atom is a lie for several reasons. Like, they're not really this color, for instance. But it's a lie for other reasons as well. Still, though, it's useful to think that this is the truth, even though you know it's not. Simply to have a mental picture. Let me distinguish between these three particles. Now, neutrons and protons are not identical in mass. Remember, mass is the amount of stuff that something's made of. They almost are identical, which is why they're shown the same size here. It's not quite identical, though. What really is very misleading, part of the lie here, is that electrons compared to protons and neutrons are much, much smaller. Now, they're shown smaller here, but it would be, to really do it to scale, you'd hardly see the electrons. All right, so there's a size difference. Protons and neutrons, roughly the same. Electrons, much smaller. Neutrons have their name because they are neutral when it comes to electrical charge. They don't have an electrical charge. They are neutral particles. The other two, protons and electrons, are charged particles. But their charges are in opposite directions. So a proton is a positively charged subatomic particle. And that's why the magenta protons here have a plus sign in them. Electrons are negatively charged subatomic particles. Importantly, despite the huge size difference and mass difference between an electron and a proton that I just mentioned, the magnitude or the size of the charge of a tiny electron is just as big as the size of the charge of a proton, just in the opposite direction. Which means if you have one of each, or in this case two of each, if you have the same number of each, protons and electrons, because of the equality of the magnitude of their charges, there is no overall charge. Two positives plus two negatives equals zero overall, right? And so that's true in general of something that we call an atom. When we say atom, really what we're referring to is a neutral atom, electrically neutral overall. It has charges in it, but it doesn't have an overall charge because the number of positives, however many there are, equals the number of negatives. Another important thing about protons and neutrons is that they are found and make up what is called the nucleus, the atomic nucleus, which is one of two senses of that word that are important in this course. I've already talked about nucleus in an entirely different way, right? The cell nucleus that you find in a eukaryotic cell is enormous. It's made up of millions of these atoms. It's enormous compared to an atom, that is. But just one individual atom has a nucleus as well. And if it doesn't have the nucleus, then you don't have an atom. So the nucleus of an atom, the atomic nucleus, is simply the number of protons and neutrons that are present, bunched together in the center of this cartoon. That's the only place that you'll find protons and neutrons. Electrons are never found in the nucleus. Electrons are always found somewhere outside of the nucleus. And I say somewhere because it's impossible, actually, for reasons that are beyond the scope of this course, to exactly predict where they are at any given moment. They do not, and this is another big part of the lie, they do not actually orbit the nucleus in a defined path like this suggests. So it's fine to keep this in mind to remember what's what, but just know that that's actually not what happens. The electrons are somewhere outside of this nucleus. We just don't know exactly where at any given moment. Okay. Now, in 5, we have the same lie on the right. On the left, it's also a lie, but it's not quite as big a lie. This is a little bit closer to the truth because you can see the nucleus. In this case, it's made up of 2 protons and 2 neutrons. You don't see any discrete electrons. What you see here is a yellow cloud, but notice that parts of it are deeper yellow and then it fades away. This yellowness represents what's called a population density. So the more vibrant the yellow, the higher the probability is that electrons are found in that region. When it fades off to white, yes, it's possible to still find electrons there, that just becomes less likely. So that's what you should think of electrons in reality as existing in a so-called electron cloud, not well-defined orbits. Okay. Now to 6. In 6, we have an atomic nucleus, and no detail is shown there, so we don't know what is in there, except that an atomic nucleus, by definition, has to include at least 1 proton. If it doesn't, then you don't have an atom. Right? Now, the simplest possibility is 1 proton, and that's it. I told you before that neutrons are found only in the nucleus, but neutrons actually don't have to be present in the nucleus. The nucleus has 1 or more protons, and it has 0 or more neutrons. And that detail isn't shown here because it's not the point of the slide. But while I'm still on this, let me say that that 1 or more protons is very important, and that has to do with the ordering of the periodic table. So when I defined elements a bit ago, I said an element is made up of only 1 kind of atom, suggesting that there's different kinds of atoms. And there are different kinds of atoms, but not because they're made of different kinds of things. Atoms are made of the same subatomic particles that we just mentioned, regardless of what element we're talking about. So when we say different kinds of atoms occurring in different elements, the difference is the number of particles, and not just any of those 3 particles, specifically protons. There's various numbers shown for each of the elements. Each box is an element. But in this version, the blue integer in the upper right of the box is the value for what we call the atomic number. Each element has an atomic number. And the periodic table is an ordered list by atomic number, starting with 1 and going up. The atomic number is the number of protons in that type of atom. And that's all it is. All right, so the atomic number tells you how many protons, and that number of protons is the only thing that makes that kind of atom that kind of atom. A hydrogen atom is hydrogen only because and if it contains exactly 1 proton. If you have an additional proton, you don't have hydrogen, you have helium, number 2, the second element. All right? So it's the number of protons that defines the element that you're dealing with when you're looking at an atom. Now, there are electrons and maybe neutrons there as well, but they do not define the element. Only the proton does. Okay. Now, in 6, we have this atomic nucleus, and then what's represented by these yellow circles, concentric circles that are around it, are not actually objects, but spaces. And these are called either electron shells or energy levels. Those are interchangeable terms. An energy level and an electron shell are the same thing. But these are not material objects. They are just spaces. And notice that these spaces are outside of the nucleus, which means that these are specifically spaces where you might find electrons. And that's why they're called electron shells. But I want you to think about these spaces by analogy with the space in a building. Just ignore the actual construction of the building. I'm talking about the space inside it. Because I'm going to give you 3 levels of spaces. There are spaces within spaces within a space within spaces. None of them is actually a material. They're just nested spaces. All right? Kind of like a house is a space, which has subspaces called rooms, which can have subspaces in them called like closets, right? They're all just spaces within spaces. Okay, well, we're looking at the large spaces when we're talking about this first one I'm mentioning, which are the electron shells or energy levels. And what we see by the arrows in this is that the energy associated with shells goes up as you go to a shell that's farther from the nucleus. So shells or energy levels are numbered. The first shell in an atom is closest to the nucleus. Farther is number 2, number 3, and so on. And as you go up in number for levels or shells, the energy associated with it is greater. All right? That means it takes energy to force an electron from one shell to another, to a higher one. And it will want to come back, and if it's able to, it will, and that will be a reduction in energy. But one really important part of this slide is that any given electron is in one shell at that moment or another shell, not between shells. That's what the staircase analogy is all about. If you actually go through with this and roll a ball downstairs, it might go all the way down, but it's possible it could stop on one of the steps, right? But it's not going to stop at a step and a half. Similarly, electrons are either in one shell or another at any given moment. Okay. That's one of the 3 spaces I'm going to talk about. Now let's go to 7 and talk about another space. So you have shells, those are larger spaces. Each shell contains some number, one or more, subspaces within it. And that next level of space is called a subshell. Okay? A subshell, what defines a subshell is the kind of subspaces that are in it. So that we're getting to the third subspace now, or the third level of space. Each subshell, in turn, is made up of some number of spaces within it that are called orbitals. And an orbital is also just a space, but it's a space where you might find electrons. Okay? There are different kinds of orbitals that have different shapes. It's just a space, not real stuff, but a space can have a shape, right? And so that's why there are different kinds of orbitals, because of their different shapes. Well, a subshell, which is the higher level compared to an orbital space, a subshell contains only one category of orbital. Here we see two different shapes. So there's two categories of orbitals shown here. Even though there's more than two categories, there's two shown here. The smaller circle here, which in three dimensions would be a sphere, is one category. That's a so-called S orbital. And you can remember that with S standing for sphere, if you like. Okay, now every level, that's the high level, the biggest of the three spaces are the levels, or shells. They're the same thing, shell and level. Every energy level contains an S orbital. So it has a spherical one. The smaller circle here is the S orbital that belongs to the first shell. And that's why it's smaller. The second level has its own S orbital, which is this bigger circle. And not shown here, the third level would have an even bigger spherical S orbital. So every level features an S orbital. And exactly one S orbital. Only one per shell. The first level contains that S orbital and no other kinds of orbitals. All right? Starting with the second level, second and higher, each of those levels, in addition to the S orbital that's in there, has three different P orbitals, which are the dumbbell-shaped ones, or infinity symbol-shaped ones. Okay, this is a single P orbital, kind of figure eight. This is another P orbital, and this is another P orbital. Well, you don't find any P orbitals in shell one. But in shell 2 and higher, each of those levels contains three different P orbitals. And the P orbitals are arranged so that they are mutually orthogonal, which simply means that each of the three is at right angles to both of the others. So they would correspond to the X, Y, and Z axes of a three-dimensional graph. You can kind of see that here in perspective, right? If we were showing the third level, which we're not in this figure, in addition to an even bigger circle, the S orbital that's in that third level, you would have three bigger P orbitals as well. Okay, so that's orbitals and shells. I haven't said much yet about subshells, except to say that every subshell contains only one category of orbitals. All right? It's easiest to start at level 2 to make sense of this. Level 2, which is one space by itself, consists of two subspaces called subshells. And one of those subshells is the S subshell, the other one is the P subshell. Okay? The P subshell, which is one space, is made up of all of the P orbitals that are in that level. That's what I meant by a subshell containing only one category of orbitals. The second level has a different subshell called the S subshell, which contains all of the S orbitals in that shell. But remember, there's only one S in every shell. Now, when you think about the first level, we still use the terms level, subshell, and orbital. But in this case, they all happen to be the same thing. The entire level contains just one subshell called the S subshell, which contains only one orbital, the S orbital. So for that first level, there's only one orbital in the entire level. Okay? Now, a very important thing that I haven't mentioned yet about any orbital, and it doesn't matter what kind it is, and there are D and F orbitals that you will study in chemistry if you take it as well, that we're not going to really talk about here. They're different shapes yet. But regardless of what kind of orbital you have, a single orbital can contain at most two electrons. Two electrons will fill an orbital of any type. That means every individual orbital has three possibilities. It has zero electrons, one electron, or two. No other possibilities. Okay? So how many orbitals are we looking at in this picture? Five total orbitals. Does everyone understand that? And how many subshells?
Two. Three.
Which are you more confident in?
I don't know.
Who else wants to chime in?
One subshell?
No. But I will give you a hint and say that one of your two answers is correct. Which is it? Is it two subshells or three? Why is it three? Name them. It is correct that it's three, but name them. Why is it three?
Because level one doesn't have, it's just one orbital shell, and then level two has two subshells.
That's right. There's a subshell in the first level called the S subshell. That's one of the three. There's a subshell in the second level called the S subshell. That's the second subshell. And there's a subshell in the second level called the P subshell. That's the third one. All right. Now, the first level's S subshell contains one orbital. And we write those down with their letter configurations. Where the hell are my pen? With letter configurations, S, P, D, and F, for instance. But we put the shell or level number in front of them. So there's the 1s orbital, that's the small sphere. That 1s orbital makes up the entire S subshell. And in the case of level 1, it also makes up the entire level. The second level has an S subshell that contains the 2s orbital. 2 here just refers to the level. It's one orbital, but it's called the 2s because it's in level 2. That's the entire subshell for the S type. And the other subshell that level 2 has is the P orbital, which contains the P subshell, which contains three different P orbitals. All three of them are 2p's. So in order not to be ambiguous, we distinguish them by putting X, Y, and Z subscripts on them. All right? So there's five overall orbitals, and there's three subshells, and there's two shells or levels. Everyone good with all that? Okay, one person is good. Okay, and if you don't tell me, like I said, I'm going to assume that you all are fine with all of this. So it can hurt you if you don't stop me. Well, this is pictured here, just what I've said in words, a little bit better in slide 8. The first shell consists of just one subshell, which itself is just one orbital. So the three things are all just different names for the same space, really, when it comes to the first shell. The second shell, though, consists of two different subshells. Each subshell, though, notice, is made up of only one category of orbitals. Whenever you have an S orbital, though, it's the only one that appears in that shell. And you only have P's in shells 2 and above, but for every one of those levels, 2 and higher, there are three different P's, an X, Y, and a Z. Okay, so the bottom picture shows you the same thing we just looked at in the previous slide. How many electrons would fill that? This whole picture at the bottom. What did you say? Everyone hear that? No, of course not, because you're not speaking as loudly as I did.
10.
Yes, it is 10. It's 10 because there are 5 overall orbitals, right? List shown here in yellow. Each one of them can contain at most 2. So 10 electrons would totally fill up all 5 of these orbitals. Okay? The picture on the top, even though, like I said, that's a lie, they don't follow these paths, it's also useful sometimes to just pretend that they're following these paths and draw these rings so that you can draw dots representing electrons within them. Okay? Now, what we see here on this particular figure, which only lists the first 2 shells, by the way, shells, which are just spaces, exist, and they're numbered 1 and higher, as I said, farther away from the nucleus. But we usually only talk about shells if that shell contains at least 1 electron. If it's totally empty, yes, it's there as a space, but we tend not to talk about it if it's totally empty. So this is an atom that has 2 shells that have at least 1 electron in it. Okay? Electrons, as I said before on that slide that showed the stairs and the ball, electrons want to occupy the lowest level they can. That's the lowest energy level. And if they're able to, they will. But remember what we said about level 1. There's only room in the entire level for at most 2 electrons, because the single 1s orbital makes up the entire subshell, which makes up the entire level itself. That means if you have an atom with a third electron, even though it might want to be at that first level, it can't, because that only available orbital is already filled. So you have to start putting those electrons in a higher energy level. Well, this one has 10 overall electrons, which you said correctly is what this bottom figure could hold. 8 of those are in the second level. Why does it make sense that the second level can hold 8? Well, P orbitals can hold 6.
Because it's got 2s and 2p.
Exactly. You have a 2s plus 3 different 2p's in the second shell. So 4 overall orbitals in just the second shell, each of which can hold up to 2 electrons, which means level 2 as an entire level gets completely filled when there are 8 electrons in it. And if you have an atom that's even bigger, that next electron can't be at these lower 2 levels. It's going to have to be in the third shell, and so on. Okay, now this is really important as far as how chemical reactions occur, because of the stability that's created when an atom's outer shell, or at least subshell, is filled. When an atom has an outer shell or subshell that is filled, that makes that particular atom very stable compared to other types of atoms. And it's not going to want to do anything. It's already very stable. It's happy, content by itself. Well, look at the periodic table, and you'll see, obviously, that it's a table. As you're used to in any given table, it's made up of rows and columns. But we use different words when we describe the periodic table. We don't say rows and columns. The rows are called periods, and the columns are called groups. Each period, each row, represents one energy level or a shell. Notice the first period. It has only two elements in it, hydrogen and helium. And they obviously could have fit a lot more boxes in there, right? But they didn't, because the first shell can house at most two electrons. Each neutral atom, back to what I was saying about the fact that when we just say atom, what we really mean is a neutral atom, has a certain number of protons that depends on what element it is, right? Only protons matter for the type of element. But if the atom is going to be neutral overall, then in addition to however many protons there are, which depends on the element type, there have to be an equal number of electrons for it to add up to zero, neutrality. So a hydrogen atom is hydrogen because it has one proton, but a neutral atom of hydrogen has to also have one electron in order for it to be neutral overall. That one electron can easily fit in the 1s orbital, which is the orbital that's closest to the hydrogen nucleus. Now, if you have a second proton, you don't have hydrogen, right? That second proton makes it helium. But a neutral atom of helium is therefore going to have two electrons to counteract the two positives. And those also fit in that same single orbital that's in that shell. When you add a third proton, though, when you're at lithium, there's three electrons, and that third electron can no longer fit in the lowest shell. That's why its lithium is listed in the second period, because it has electrons in the second shell, and so on down the periods. Okay, now 2 is special for period 1. 2 electrons makes that atom very stable because it's a full shell, and that's helium. All of the ones in that group, and remember, group means column, are particularly stable elements. These ones on the right edge are called the noble gases, and they are inert, chemically inert, which means because of their stability, since they all feature a full outer shell or subshell, they don't want to engage in chemical reactions. They're happy the way they are because of that fullness. And you find them just as individual atoms. All of the rest of the elements are at least partially dissatisfied compared to the noble gases. They aren't as stable because they don't have a full outer shell or subshell. And so by rearranging particles with other elements, or more of themselves, in a chemical reaction, they can gain stability. That's why chemical reactions happen. The rearrangement of the particles is such that there is greater stability. They become just like the noble gases with respect to fullness of their outer shells or subshells. Okay? So 2 is an important number for the first period. But there's only 2 elements involved. So there's not all that many chemical reactions. The second one, though, these are important chemicals of living organisms. Notice that's where you find carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, 3 of the big 4s. Hydrogen's up here on the first one, but the other big 3 of the 4 are in the second period. So there's a lot of chemistry involved there. But for the second period, or second shell, 8 is the important number. Because there's 4 orbitals in that shell, each of which can hold 2 electrons. And that's the basis of the so-called octet rule in chemistry. For levels 2 and above, 8 is a special number because it will fill either the entire shell or a subshell within that shell, giving it stability. Well, the noble gases already have that. Neon has 10 overall electrons because what makes it neon is that it has 10 protons. Therefore, the neutral version has 10 electrons as well. Well, that's stable because 2 of them fill up the first shell. The other 8 fill up the second shell. That's what makes it happy. Sodium, the next one after that, wants to be like neon. All right, but it's going to have to rearrange things in order for it to be like neon. And that's coming up, but I forgot about this slide first. Slide 9 is just an abbreviated periodic table. It's only part of what you see over here. But it's the part that really matters to biology. It's just the first few periods. And you see these drawings, these circles with dots in them. The dots, remember, represent electrons. What does each circle represent? Which is it, a shell or a subshell? Shell, not subshell. Now, certainly they're not orbitals. How do you know definitely that they're not orbitals?
It's just a circle. There's not the spherical one or the...
Well, even just forgetting about the shape, you should know from looking at these that these cannot be orbitals. Why? Right. Some of them have more than 2 electrons, right? So they can't be orbitals. And for a similar reason, they can't be subshells either. These are entire shells. So this second shell, there's 4 orbitals in it. That's why at the right edge with neon, you have 8 possible electrons in it. That's 2 subshells big, right? There's an S subshell in there and a P subshell, but 4 total orbitals. Okay, so that's what these circles are all about. And notice that the right edge always has these filled on the outer one. On that shell or subshell. Okay. Now we can go to what I was thinking I was going to a moment ago in slide 10 and revisit this chemical reaction that we started with on this chapter. Specifically, sodium and chlorine reacting to form sodium chloride. This introduces the notion of ions. Now, atom, like I said, usually means neutral atom, meaning no overall charge. Ion always means charged. An ion is a charged particle. Now, it can be involve a single atomic nucleus or multiple. There are what are called polyatomic ions, made up of multiple atoms that collectively have a charge. But here we'll stick to just monatomic ions. And sodium is 11 on the periodic table. It's here on the left edge. Chlorine, number 17, on the right edge, or near the right edge. This brings up the fact that the periodic table has 2 major categories of elements in it, which are the metals and the nonmetals. Now, there are actually more categories, but it's instructive to think of these two major categories first. Metals and nonmetals, and they are not equally represented. There are relatively few nonmetals in the universe, and they are really just these ones that are, other than the noble gases, those don't count, the ones in this triangle right here, these are the nonmetals. Upper right hand, except for the noble gases. All the other ones to the left of that triangle, hydrogen is also included in the nonmetals. All of the rest of them, everything except hydrogen that's to the left of that triangle I just showed you, are metals. So most elements are metals. But notice that on the periodic table, the metals are on the left, toward the left side. Nonmetals are toward the right. And I told you that that right edge is special as far as stability is concerned, right? Well, the nonmetals, notice, are over there on that right side because their outer shell is more filled than non-filled. You can tell that by how close they are to the edge. The edge, the noble gases, are filled. If you go one step to the left, that's one fewer electron because of the way it's arranged, right? So fluorine, for instance, is almost full, like neon is, but it can hold one more electron in its outer shell. All right? That's true of nonmetals in general. They have outer shells that are more filled than non-filled. But for metals, they have outer shells that are more empty than filled. Now, both of these types of elements, metals and nonmetals, would like to gain the stability of one of these noble gases on the edge. They would like to get into the situation where their outer shell is filled. Okay? But that's going to require a change in the number of electrons to do that. Nonmetals, since they are mostly empty, find it easier to attain the stability of the noble gases by losing electrons. Let's just look at sodium, since that's part of this example. Sodium here at number 11 has 11 protons and therefore 11 electrons, 2 in the first shell, 8 in the second shell, and then one more. That third shell is almost empty, but you have to put that remaining electron in the third shell. Well, if sodium just gets rid of that one electron that it has, then that third shell we don't even consider since it's empty at this point, right? And therefore, the outer shell at that point would be shell 2, which is already filled. So sodium, by losing one electron, becomes like neon, nice and stable. And that's what happens with metals. They form ions by losing electrons. Nonmetals are more full than empty, so they can gain the stability of the right edge by taking on a small number of electrons. That's easier than losing a larger number of electrons. And chlorine at 17 is just one step away from argon. All it needs is one more electron to be stable like argon. All right? Now another batch of definitions. Ion is a general term that means a charged atom, not a neutral atom. But notice that there is, if you just think about it logically, there's four ways that you could change the charge of an atom from neutral. And that's because there's two different charged particles, right? Protons and electrons. And there's two ways that you can change the number. You can gain them or lose them. So you could make a neutral atom positively charged by adding a proton. That's not how ions are formed, though, because if you add a proton, you don't have the same element anymore. So gaining protons and losing protons, even though logically it would work, that's out. That's not how ions are formed. There are therefore two ways that ions can be formed, which is to gain electrons or lose electrons. And just keep in mind that electrons are negatively charged. So if an atom loses an electron, it becomes positively charged. It still has the same number of protons, which are all positive, but now it has one fewer electrons, not enough electrons to add up to zero, right? So it would be like positive 6 plus negative 5. That adds up to positive 1. That's what metals do. They lose some number of electrons to become not only ions, but positively charged ions. And ions is the overall group or set. The positively charged ions are called cations. And the negatively charged ones are called anions. Okay? Now, in the specific case of having a sodium atom and a chlorine atom, both neutral to begin with, it's a perfect arrangement with respect to both of these becoming stable like a noble gas. Because sodium, just by getting rid of this only electron that's in its current outer shell, will no longer have that as its outer shell. I mean, the shell's there, but it's empty, right? So its outer shell would be this one, which is already filled. That's what it wants to do. It wants to lose that electron. But chlorine gladly will take it off its hands because it has its outer shell that is just one electron short of being full. And therefore, that's what happens. This is one example of a chemical bond forming. There are different categories of chemical bonds. This is the first that I'm giving you. And it's called an ionic bond. An ionic bond forms between a metal and a nonmetal. And in all cases, because of what I've said about half filled or less filled or more filled, in all cases of ionic bonds, the metal loses some number of electrons and the nonmetal gains. So there's a transfer of an electron at least in an ionic bond formation. But a single transfer of this one atom simultaneously produces two ions, right? The sodium becomes a cation and the chlorine becomes an anion because neither of them add up to zero anymore. All right, they're doing that just because of the stability involved in a filled outer shell. But as soon as they become ions, the fact that they are oppositely charged is what holds them together. So that is the force behind an ionic bond. It's the force of electrostatic attraction when you have two different charges, positive and negative, attract each other. Probably getting close to the end, right? Yeah, better stop. All right, we'll continue.